Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Monday, the 16th of July, a major study released last week, and it is titled Stigma, Obesity, and the Health of the Nation's Children, done by Dr. Rebecca Puhl from Yale University and Dr. Janet Latner from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And this looked at all of the information, all the studies that have been done on the effects of societal stigmatization on overweight and obese children and adolescents. It found that they are victims of bias and stereotyping by peers, also by parents, which is an astounding part of this report. It's particularly concerning, the authors write, during childhood and adolescence, when the formation of social relationships is salient, children may be especially vulnerable and sensitive to weight stigmatization and its consequences. This could hinder their social, emotional, and academic development and could exacerbate adverse medical outcomes that they already face, and our guests will outline those. So the paper that they wrote reviews existing literature on weight stigma in children and adolescents, with attention to the assessment, nature, and extent of weight bias toward young people and the primary sources of stigma in their lives. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I would imagine we'll have more than quite a few this hour because it is a huge problem in our society. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you be joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Dr. Puhl, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Puhl is Associate Research Scientist and Coordinator, Community and Weight Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Dr. Janet Latner, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Hawaii. Thank you, Dr. Latner, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And our, we'll be welcoming phone calls in a moment. And it would probably anticipate that there would be some bullying involved. What is amazing to me about your study is the pervasiveness of this stigmatization coming from everybody, including parents in these young people's lives, which is hard to imagine.
Yeah, that's correct. I think it's important to recognize that what these studies are showing is that today's overweight and obese youth are really vulnerable targets of weight bias in every aspect of their lives, at school from peers, which I think most people would not be surprised to learn, but also from educators and parents, which is especially concerning.
Right. And let's start with the parents here. How could parents be saying negative comments? And some of them are saying comments and they're obese themselves.
Well, the studies that have examined this show that some parents express negative stereotypes about obese individuals and that these get communicated to their children in various communication patterns. Other studies have actually surveyed very large samples of adolescents and found that high percentages of adolescents report that they're being teased about their weight from family members.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, please, Dr. Latner, some of the very, very serious long-term emotional and physical consequences of this. This is serious.
It looks like people who are stigmatized as children, both when they're children and when they become adults, are at greater risk for things like low self-esteem, depression, and even suicidal behaviors. Mm. They have problems in their peer relationships. And there is mixed evidence about socioeconomic and academic consequences. There is also evidence of eating disturbances and lower physical activity. And there's even new recent research on cardiovascular risk, which we really need a lot more research to identify because these kids are already at increased risk, as you said earlier.
Mm-hmm. And the number of young people who are overweight or obese continues to go up, Dr. Puhl. How did you factor that into the study? Even though there are more people who are obese or overweight, still the stigmatization continues.
That's correct. I think some people might expect, you know, as increasing prevalence rates of obesity go up, that maybe people would become less biased or there would be more tolerance. But in fact, that does not appear to be the case at all. And in fact, research by Janet Latner, who's on this call as well, has shown that the stigma is actually getting worse, especially among children. So despite the fact that we've got this problem in our country that is getting worse, the stigma also appears to be worsening.
Why is that, Dr. Latner?
Well, it could very well be because of increased messages about the thin ideal, that it is now prized more than ever before, perhaps, to be thin. For example, if you look at Miss America contestants and magazine centerfolds, we see this decrease in body mass index over the years. So that's one possibility. And we do think that stigma is perhaps associated with that, and it also might be associated with transmission from parents and the media.
Mm-hmm. Have you also, the flip side of this is, and I know that both of you have thought of this extensively, are there strategies that do work to address the problem of overweight and obese children, to get them to shed some of those pounds? Are there positive reinforcers that we seem to be overlooking?
Well, I think that one of the most important messages of existing nutrition interventions or prevention programs for obesity is to really emphasize eating behaviors rather than the number on the scale. That's a very difficult thing for children to be able to control in terms of having goals to lose a certain number of pounds. But when we focus on eating behaviors, eating more fruits and vegetables, eating fewer high-calorie-dense foods, that's a tangible goal that children can focus on.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about social stigmatization, can you tell me what form it takes and if it's different among educators or peers or parents?
There are certainly multiple forms of victimization, and I think that's a very important point to highlight. It can be verbal teasing and derogatory comments or name-calling, which is very common among peers. But there is also physical aggression and bullying, and that's everything from kicking and shoving and pushing, and also social rejection and ostracism. And I think there's a range of these behaviors that are being expressed both by peers. I think when it comes from parents and teachers, it may be through more subtle types of communications, although there are studies indicating that negative stereotypes are also expressed quite openly.
What about with parents?
With parents, there's really, of the handful of studies that have looked at this, for example, some population-based studies that have surveyed, thousands of adolescents find that high percentages report that they are getting teased by family members. And so it's possible that parents and other family members may be expressing verbal comments that are stigmatizing. And I think it's important to think about that biased attitudes from parents could potentially in part stem from stigma that they themselves feel because their child is overweight or obese. There's some research that has found that parents of overweight children report that they feel blamed and criticized for their child's weight and may feel anger or frustration in response to this because they don't know how to help. And so it's possible that these perceptions, may take out frustration on their child by adopting stigmatizing attitudes and behaviors like making critical or negative comments. And this isn't something that's really been tested yet, but it does seem that it's worth pursuing that.
And let's spend a little more time with educators, because it seems to me as though if some of this is going on in the classroom, which is where you want somebody to guide you along and give you a good life, that if you are perceived because you are overweight to be lazy, if you are perceived to be not very bright, do some teachers have that perception simply because of a child's weight?
Yes, there have been studies reporting biased attitudes among teachers, and this is some recent studies, for example, have found that some teachers have lower expectations for their overweight students compared to thinner students, and that's across a range of performance areas. And I think you're right that, overweight students need allies in school settings, and so it's very important that teachers be aware of this issue and be educating their students about the issue and the seriousness of it.
Mm-hmm. I know that the study also, and there isn't a whole lot of information about this, but when you look at different ethnic groups in this country, is there a difference in terms of how they are involved in social stigmatization or not of their young people? Are some ethnic groups better at this, more sensitive than others?
There's only a handful of studies, again, that have really looked at ethnicity in relation to weight bias as well. And I think what we can conclude at this point is that children and adolescents of varying ethnic backgrounds are vulnerable to weight bias, that it's not just something that Caucasian children, for example, are experiencing. So we certainly need more work in that area. But of the limited work that does exist, this does appear to be an issue that is affecting children of different races.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about the depression that can result from this. What are the emotional repercussions of being stigmatized in this way, Dr. Lattner, in terms of school performance, in terms of, well, all kinds of areas in life?
Well, what we've theorized in our writing is that it's possible that some of the link between emotional problems and childhood obesity that have been documented sporadically in the past may in fact be due to weight bias. It looks like when you control for body mass, there is still an existing relationship between certain emotional consequences and the experiences of being stigmatized, whereas there's no remaining relationship between body mass and emotional consequences. So, and this might indeed be the case for health as well. So we think that it's possible weight bias is driving many of the problems in these children's lives as a result of their treatment by others rather than as a result of their body weight.
Interesting. And some of this stigmatization happens very, very early, as young as three. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Some studies have documented the age at which stigma begins, and children as young as three are already more likely to say that when they hear a story about a mean child and are asked who is that child and shown several pictures, they are already more likely to pick the overweight child and say that child is mean. Mm-hmm. So they already identify fat as good, as bad, as early as three.
Mm-hmm. What about?
But it seems to increase over development as well.
What about differences between boys and girls in terms of how much bullying is going on here? Are girls better than boys? Are they about the same here?
Well, there are mixed findings about whether girls and boys express different levels of weight bias and whether one sex is more vulnerable to stigma than the other. Some studies have found no differences, whereas other work finds that girls may be more strongly victimized than boys. And that's probably not so surprising when we consider how strict the ideals of female physical attractiveness are in Western society. But we certainly need more research to try to clarify the nature and extent of this problem among girls and boys, and to determine whether there really are significant gender differences in how kids experience weight bias.
There is some research looking at differences in the form of bias too. Girls are more likely to experience relational victimization, which is being excluded by peers and being talked about behind one's back.
Right.
And boys are more likely to experience physical bullying.
Right. And this little fact that came out of this, which I find amazing, studies showing that overweight girls got less financial college support from parents than average weight girls did.
Yeah, that's correct. That was a very interesting study.
Yes.
That, you know, I think it's easy to hear that finding and to say, well, maybe it's because of the family size or because of the income level. But this study actually controlled for a whole range of variables that could account for those findings. And what it looks like is that overweight girls in particular received less financial support for education than boys or other youth of non-overweight status.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking with the authors of Stigma, Obesity, and the Health of the Nation's Children, a major report that was just released last week, published by the American Psychological Association. Our guests are Dr. Rebecca Puhle, who is Associate Research Scientist and Coordinator, Community and Weight Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Dr. Janet Lattner is Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Hawaii and is also the editor of Self-Help Approaches for Obesity and Eating Disorders, Research and Practice. To your phone calls in just a moment. Our number again, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, ring us at 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now at 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Patty from Rice Lake. Hi, Patty.
Hi, good morning. I have been wrangling with myself. I have never felt a prejudice towards any group, but I am experiencing a growing bias against obesity, and I'm really struggling with that. And in one area that I have a hard time, when I'm in a caregiving position for children, like if I'm working in a daycare or in a classroom, I've noticed that it's okay to encourage children that are skinny to eat more, but it doesn't seem to be okay to say to the overweight child, eat less. And I find that I'm not quite sure what to do in that quandary, and I'd like to take your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks very much. That's a great question. What should she do, doctors?
Well, to echo one thing that Dr. Poole said earlier, I think it's really important to encourage particular behaviors rather than to encourage numbers on a scale. And it does sound like you are thinking about eating behaviors in general, so perhaps encouraging all the kids to eat healthy and encouraging all of them to do physical activity during recess and not focusing on any particular ones and singling them out.
I think that's a great point, and I think a lot of times it's easy to think that kids or adolescents who are thin are healthy, and that's just not the case. There are many kids today who are not overweight but who are eating unhealthy foods and consuming unhealthy beverages, and so I think the message needs to be for all children, regardless of their body size, that they need to be eating healthy.
And this other message, and schools, as both of you know, I'm sure, have cut back significantly on physical education programs because there's so much testing going on that you hear about recess being eliminated and PE programs. Maybe the country really needs to embark on another physical fitness kind of program so that kids are moving.
That's certainly true. I think that physical education does need to be a regular part of every child's day at school and out of school. I think one of the things that we need to consider when it comes to weight bias is that very often children who are overweight or obese are very self-conscious during physical activities, and often because that's where they're victimized and teased by peers. And so it's important that any kind of interventions that address physical activity also really consider the sensitivity of the issue of weight bias and try to find ways for these children to enjoy participating in these activities without feeling stigmatized.
Right. So it becomes, you don't want to put on a swimming suit because you're overweight, and so you don't swim, and so
exactly.
You sit in front of the TV.
Exactly.
And so how do you address that in a sensitive way?
Well, I think one thing is making sure that schools are aware of this issue and are addressing weight bias with the legitimacy that other forms of bias are addressed in existing diversity curriculum or educational programs in schools that address bullying and teasing. You know, without an awareness of what the issue is, it's going to be hard to address it, and I think that's really the first step.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mary from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Go right ahead, Mary.
Okay. I work in a school as a nurse, and I see what these children bring for lunch, these convenience lunches that are all packed together, extremely high in fat and salt, and yes, they like them because this is what they've grown up with, the McDonald's type of thing when they're 1 and 2 years old, not good. It trains their taste buds that this is what they want, and yes, physical activity is curtailed in the schools because of the academic standards that have to be met. But anyway, I do believe it's the parents' responsibility to make sure that they have a healthy variety of food and to start that in the home and continue it in the schools, and the teachers need to be clued in if a child has a problem.
You want to take that one, Dr. Leidner? Want to start?
That sounds like perhaps a possible area for where a nurse could say something to parents if they were so concerned. It's possible that the parents, like the child, don't know any differently, were raised with these types of foods and are passing them on to their child. And I think that's an important thing to be handled sensitively in a way that doesn't make anyone feel blamed or victimized in any way. So perhaps to arrange a private communication or a personal contact in some way.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mary, for the call. When you look at the numbers, and you cite them at the beginning of your study release last week, that by the year 2010, it's expected the number of overweight children will increase with almost 50%, I repeat, of children in North America and 38% of children in the European Union becoming overweight. We're talking about a revolution that needs to take place in terms of what we eat, in terms of exercise, or else the consequences for society are going to be phenomenal, Dr. Poole.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, this is an epidemic that we're facing right now, and I think that there is a lot of media attention to the medical consequences of obesity and concern for children in general, but we certainly need to change the way that we're approaching this problem. We really do need to focus on the environment that we're living in that is perpetuating obesity and really find ways to curb this issue before it continues to get out of control like this.
Would you like to comment on that as well, Dr. Lattner?
Oh, I agree 100%. I think we really do need to think more in terms of prevention of this public health problem instead of picking up the pieces after the fallout's occurred.
Right. And is it a lifelong? I've heard that if you struggle with this issue for so many people in your childhood, in your adolescence, that you're just on this lifelong weight concern. It just stays with you for years and years in many cases. Is that true?
I certainly think that the effects of weight bias especially can be very far-reaching because of the damage on self-esteem and body image that Dr. Lattner mentioned previously. We also know that there are some studies that have looked retrospectively at adults recalling their childhoods when they were victimized and teased and reporting that it really did affect their eating behaviors and their well-being in adulthood. So, yes, I do think that this is a potentially very long-lasting issue.
I think that also speaks to the fact that losing weight may not be the cure for weight bias,
exactly,
because the changes can remain after weight is already lost. Person's psychology is affected, and those changes stay.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's evidence about residual body dissatisfaction after weight loss, where people who've lost weight have a lot worse feelings about their body than people who are the same weight but were never fat. And that could very well be the case for psychological consequences of weight bias, too.
What do you mean they have body dissatisfaction? They're dissatisfied with what?
With their self-image when it concerns their body.
Let's go to another caller in, to Karen from Green Bay. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I was always an overweight kid and obese when I was in high school, but I had the most horrendous experience with my gym teachers. I'm sure a lot of kids didn't have a real good time in gym when they were overweight, but aside from the just disgustingly snide remarks he used to make about my weight in front of the entire class, and he would have me run extra laps after class was over with all the kids watching. And I would go to my guidance counselor and, my principal and things like that, and they always made it, to be my problem. Like, it was my fault that I couldn't get along with these teachers. And when I was in school, I found absolutely not a shred of support from any of the staff at all. No sympathy whatsoever. It was always my problem that I wasn't, doing well. And this teacher especially was just allowed to, carry on just harassing people, not just me, other kids. And he would even threaten in front of the whole class that he was going to put me in the handicap gym. They had a special handicap class for gym class for those kids, and he would threaten me in front of the whole class he was going to put me in there if I couldn't speed up and keep up with the other kids. So it just was a horrible experience for me.
How are you now?
Well, I have body issues like everyone else, and I'm still, an obese as an adult, but I try to lose weight, and I just wish there would be some sort of support for these kids at school, because it is not easy to go through high school, middle school, elementary school as overweight. You just, you're shrunk to nothing.
Right.
They stomp all over you. That's what it's like.
Yeah. Don't go away. I'm sure that the doctors would like to speak with you, too. Dr. Peel, you want to start?
Well, yeah, first I just want to say thank you for sharing your story. And I think, unfortunately, this is the kind of experience that many people are reporting. And just like you said, we know from the science, too, that kids who start experiencing this early, experiencing it through elementary school, high school, and college, and the effects of this are detrimental. And I think, one of the things that you pointed out is just the importance of having allies at school. And I can't emphasize that enough. And I think, it sounds like that you are really faced with even teachers and other professionals at school placing blame on you, which is unfortunately something that often happens with weight bias because of very common notions of personal responsibility for body weight in our society. And I think that these views are so prevalent that it's easy to miss that they can really reinforce perceptions of blame and unhealthy stereotypes, which only really contribute to weight bias. And so I think, you know, the example that you've just given us with your experiences really highlights the importance for really educating schools about this issue and making sure that there are allies for children.
Right. Dr. Lettner?
I agree, and it's really a shame what happened to you, and thank you for sharing that. I think that we've looked at research that's examined physical educators' attitudes, and unfortunately that is one group in particular that does seem to have biased attitudes that may even increase during their training, as a 2000 study showed. So as physical educators become professionally trained, they may learn something, maybe perhaps about the control of body weight, that might increase their negative attitudes. And I think that's particularly harmful because physical activity can be so empowering for young children, even overweight children, including everyone. And it does detriment it has a detrimental effect on these children's motivation to do physical activity when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what it would have taken, and it's really not all that much. It's just sort of, instead of this punitive approach, run extra laps, everybody watch you, if this teacher had been sensitive enough to Karen's sensitivity about her weight and approached it in a whole different manner, it could have changed her life, right?
Well, I actually had a female gym teacher my senior year, because this guy failed me my first 2 years. No matter what I did, I was always too slow, so I would run the 2 miles, but he would still fail me because it would take me a half hour to do it. But my senior year, I finally got a female teacher, and she would let me go outside while the other kids stayed inside, let me run the laps by myself or go out there with my friends. So I found that the female gym teachers were a lot more sensitive than the male teachers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Reed next from Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Good morning. I was an educator for many years, almost 40 years, and for a good part of that, I taught in a minority population, and which I will not name, but I would say that a higher percentage, I believe, of those individuals that I had as students were overweight, and yet they did not seem to suffer from as much negative stereotyping, and in some cases, perhaps, they even used this to their benefit, and it was almost, in a sense, a positive aspect.
That's a really good point that you raise, and there is some limited research that has demonstrated kind of what you're talking about, specifically looking at perceptions of body weight and stigmatization in African-American populations, with some research suggesting that perhaps there is a higher level of acceptance in the African-American community, although whether they are targeted less, I think, remains questionable, although Dr. Lettner may be able to speak to that as well.
Dr. Lettner?
They can be targeted equally, as we were talking about before, but there may be a difference in self-image. Again, the concept of body satisfaction and body image, there has been systematic research showing that certain minority groups can be protected from the negative impact of body dissatisfaction, which is perhaps a real strength that we can learn from and perhaps even apply and learn what it is that they're doing and thinking to be protected from all of the negative consequences of body image and dissatisfaction.
Yeah. Thanks, Reed, for your call. Our next caller is Dale from West Allis. Hi, Dale.
Hi. You know, I was a fat kid in high school, too, and I felt, bad about it. My parents were not particularly easy on me about it. My siblings were not easy about it. Classmates were absolutely vicious. Gym teachers were vicious. You know, and you look around today and you got, for example, your Jay Leno and your David Letterman and Conan O'Brien, all of them every night have at least one or two fat jokes.
Really?
That go on. Some of us have suffered real badly from it. I never had a date in high school, ever, and I haven't had a date in 20 years. Just because of my size. People say they like me, but they just don't want to be seen with me. It's an incredibly unfair society we have, and it's got to be horribly damaging on the kids. I've been depressed since high school, basically. I deal with it. I'm alone. And that's really about all that I can do about it. I've tried every weight loss program there is out there, and nothing works. And that includes exercise. And it just doesn't. Some of us are just meant to be this way, it seems.
Yeah, stay with us, Dale. We don't want to leave you in this situation. Dr. Lattner?
Well, a couple of things come to mind, and thank you so much for sharing your very important personal experience. It does sound like you've experienced awful consequences from obesity stigma, and it really brings to mind how far we need to go with this prejudice, which can be compared to perhaps racism 50 years ago in our society, and why it doesn't seem right that obesity stigma is the last acceptable form of prejudice, and we need to combat this. It is as important as racism or any other religious minorities group's prejudice, or any other prejudice out there. There are support groups that can help you cope with the after effects of the stigma, which is one of Dr. Poole's areas of expertise, is the coping with stigma. And
yeah, but you want to hear something really horrible about it? I don't want to be in a group with a bunch of other fat people. I don't want to be seen with fat people either. The bias even affects me and how I feel towards fat people. And I'm one of them.
Hmm.
Well, and I think that's actually something that is also supported by the research, that negative attitudes and this bias is expressed by a range of individuals and at a range of different body weights. And I think that's because we have such negative associations that are communicated in our society. One of the things that, you know, made me think of the media portrayals when you were mentioning that in your experience is that to change this form of bias, we really need to shift societal attitudes in a major way. And this requires that we look to sources in our society where bias is being perpetuated. And just like you said, media portrayals of obese and overweight individuals is certainly one place that needs to be changed. Very often in television and film and, you know, on comedy shows, overweight and obese individuals are negatively stereotyped and portrayed in ways that really fuel weight bias. And when we consider how much media our current society consumes, that's a very concerning message that's being sent, especially to children.
Now, what about Dale's incredible isolation here, though? I'm sure that deep down he doesn't really want to live that way, Dr. Poole.
Well, I agree. I think that the effects of this for things like loneliness and low self-esteem are things that have been well documented. And, you know, this really requires activism and changes in the way that we perceive body weight. And I think that there are things that people can do to really bring a voice to this issue. As an example, if we think about other forms of more widely recognized stigmas like racial bias or gender bias, these are types of biases that have legal sanctions in place to protect people from discrimination. But weight bias and discrimination is an area where there are no legal sanctions and where we do need legislation. If we continue to allow this form of bias to continue without any kind of legislation, then we're essentially sending the message to our citizens that this is a form of bias that is acceptable and tolerated, and that's very problematic. So I do think that the more that people can voice their concerns about this, that there is a chance of making some changes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call, Dale. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. A major study done by the guests we have on this hour released last week, Stigma, Obesity, and the Health of the Nation's Children, we're looking at the social stigma that those young people who are obese face. It is pervasive and can have very serious consequences for emotional and physical health. Our guests are Dr. Rebecca Poole, Associate Research Scientist and Coordinator, Community and Weight Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Dr. Janet Lattner, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Hawaii and editor, she is, of Self-Help Approaches for Obesity and Eating Disorders, Research and Practice. Lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to your phone calls. Muhammad from Madison is next. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
You know, I'm not overweight. I'm 57, and I've got a little around the middle I could lose, but I have no idea what it's like to be seriously overweight where you are rejected. But when the gentleman who said he was overweight at the end said that he didn't want to be around other people who were overweight, it reminded me of the dilemma of being African-American sometimes when, without being asked or just by default, you're lumped with other African-Americans that you don't know, may not like yourself, don't necessarily want to be around, but for that reason, I'll say. It's quite a dilemma. And he could lose weight and probably would change his whole perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I will always be African-American, not that I'm complaining about it, but I will always be African-American. And that just when he said that, it just sort of struck me. And she immediately, your guest, I apologize, I don't know her name, but she immediately understood what he was talking about. And sometimes that's not understood about African-Americans who are sometimes lumped with other African-Americans or given the criticism if something negative happens. It's just not quite understood as easily as when this gentleman said he didn't want to be around other heavyweight people, even though he's heavyweight himself.
Right, right. Yeah. Interesting comment. Dr. Lattner, you want to start?
Well, when it comes to weight bias, you put your finger on it, as to our previous caller. People with high weights of their own often are just as stigmatizing as people who are not overweight. And there doesn't seem to be any in-group valuation where people appreciate others who are going through the same thing more. In fact, they appreciate them less, just like everyone else does. And another important point that you made is that he perceives the possibility of removing himself from that stigmatized group, which is different from other types of minority status, such as ethnic minority groups or religious or sexual minority groups, where people generally stay in the same category. But the flexibility to change one's weight is a lot narrower than people generally perceive.
Really?
The vast majority of people who lose substantial amounts of weight do gain it back eventually. The major problem with weight loss is its long-term maintenance. And only a very small minority of the general population ever do succeed in maintaining large weight losses.
Mm.
So we are, to some extent, stuck with our weight category more than people perceive. So there is perhaps less going in and out of that group.
And to echo what Dr. Lattner is saying, there are a number of randomized clinical control trials that have been done in research to really look at, you know, how likely is it that a person can really lose a significant amount of weight and keep it off. And the findings are very disappointing. And what they're showing is that it's really not reasonable to expect that a person can lose more than 5 to 15% of their body weight and keep it off. There are, as Janet Lattner said, a minority of people who can do that. But for the vast majority of the population, that's just not the case, and we do need to be sensitive to the difficulties of weight loss.
Hmm. So we need to be accepting that there are people who are overweight, right? It's just they're going to be overweight for their lifetimes.
Well, it certainly is much easier to gain weight than it is to lose weight.
Not
and
true.
I think, you know, of the patients that I've treated and talked to, I mean, this is a recurring theme that it is just an ongoing struggle, and that our society does not really appreciate that, and certainly tries to send an opposing message through the diet industry that if you just take a pill, you'll be able to lose weight successfully. And I think that's a very unhealthy and concerning message.
How much money is in the diet industry every year? Do either of you know? It must be billions.
I know it is billions, although I don't know the actual figure.
I think $30 billion is the one I...
Is it really? Wow. Muhammad, thank you very much. Unless you had something else you wanted to say.
You.
All right, thanks so much for your call. Sharon is next from Appleton. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I jumped into the show a little late, and I've been listening to the past few callers, and thinking about the fact that genetically there are some people that are just going to be having, they could even eat cardboard and water, and they're going to be having no matter what they do. I was just wondering if there's any programs in place or any kind of research looking at raising kids to eat the best they can and be the most active they can without even talking about dieting or losing weight. I mean, is there anything out there that would foster this kind of feeling with kids, so it helps our self-esteem, it helps acceptance with obesity, as well as just raising people to be healthy and not focus on the weight. Does anybody foresee any programs or research in place for that? And maybe we will raise a society where there's more accepting, less prejudice, at the same time being very healthy, and maybe even have a lower obesity rate.
Certainly, from my knowledge, existing research is taking the tone that you're suggesting right now, which is saying that the messages from teachers, from parents, from school-based programs should be one that focuses on eating behaviors rather than the number on the scale. So certainly, I think that that's a direction that some people are looking into, and I think a very valuable way of doing interventions for this.
Okay, well, thank you, because I work with a lot of children, and you know, just talking to the parents and the children, they just look at me blankly when I say, you need to eat better, you need to eat better, and they're coming back at me as, well, how much weight does my child need to lose? I'm like, no, you need to work on eating healthier, and I just am at a loss to find resources to help foster that.
Well, and I also think that, you know, this really requires also changing the school food environment so that children are surrounded by healthy choices and that healthy choices are the default instead of the fries or the pizza or the other unhealthy food choices that are often there in schools. And I think that we're on the road in the right direction for that, but that there's still quite a long way to go.
But don't you find that once the child is out of the school environment, when they go home, a lot of their calories are consumed after school till bedtime? I mean, they're only in that little environment for so long, and then...
That's certainly a question that has been posed, especially by some of the food industries who have been saying that they don't want their foods taken out of the school system. But actually, there is some research to suggest that kids do not compensate for calories that they don't get in school. I certainly think more research is needed on that, but there is that finding that's in place.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. This force from advertising and from peer pressure, et cetera, must be very strong, because it's hard to believe, for me to believe, that there wouldn't be all kinds of classroom instruction all over this country in nutrition programs, in what you ought to eat. I know that the kids in my family certainly have gone through those. They know. We all, you have to have your eyes totally closed to not know what's good for you. Am I wrong?
Well, from my knowledge, the quality and amount of nutrition education in schools varies quite widely, and I don't know how that is being evaluated or what's keeping it in check to make sure that the proper messages are being really portrayed to children.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare the budget of school nutrition programs to the budget of, say, just one major soft drinks advertising budget, it's really a drop in the bucket. And the bucket's not made of water.
Right. Is it Tut from Baraboo?
Yes, it is.
Hi.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the advertising, because that's what I think is driving kids and obesity. It's much stronger than education, and that's true across the board. These kids have been victims of advertising since they were born. Kids are watching TV at the age of one. And I think that they're just inundated with advertising cues about food. You know, and researchers are telling us that we make 120 decisions every day about food choices and how much. And, you know, the advertising, they can't get away from it. Even in the schools, they see the Pizza Hut signs and the burgers and whatever, the subs or whatever. But I think that we need to go back to advertising and look at the effect that it's had on young children from very on, and recognize that it's almost impossible to detach yourself from that.
That's an excellent point, and I'm glad that you raised it. It can't be underemphasized, the importance of food marketing and advertising to children, and I think that that's a very important factor in contributing to today's obesity in children. What we know from research is that children see at least 10,000 commercials for food every year, and that 95% of those are for unhealthy foods like sugared cereals or junk food or sodas. And if you compare that as a parent, if you were to say to your child every day for 1 year, you know, it's important to eat healthy, that's 365 messages from a parent compared to 10,000 messages from the industry, who is
really so honed and skilled at making these messages effective. And so I completely agree with you that our efforts and intervention efforts and prevention efforts really need to focus on the effects of marketing and advertising. And there are other countries outside of the United States that are already banning advertising to children, especially for food products, but the United States is not one of them.
I think it would be a good idea.
Yeah.
We just finished a camp, a four-week camp, and kids came to our meals, and we would ask them, how hungry are you? And they weren't hungry. Now, we were outside playing the whole day, as every kid who goes to camp does. But I attribute that in great part to the lack of food and eating cues.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see that in the camp environment. It's a pure environment. And the kids were really surprised that they're not hungry. And they don't think about food. It's rather incredible.
Thank you so much for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Isn't that something? She said something that we probably don't think about much during the day, whether or not you're hungry. How many of us eat when we're not hungry? You just eat because you eat. I'll bet a lot of us do that.
Right. There's recent research by Michael Lowe and others on how much the food environment interacts with our appetite system and makes us eat when we're not necessarily hungry or thinking
right.
about food otherwise. It's kind of a hedonic response that we're just surrounded by these palatable foods and exciting stimuli out there.
Right.
And that's why we overeat.
Yeah. Let's go next to Wayne from Green Bay. Hello, Wayne.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wanted to know what your self-perception of whether you're fat or skinny has to do with your eating. When I was a kid, I was always overweight, and all my life I have perceived myself as being overweight, even though when I was in the military and in my 20s, I was not. I got fat again, and I've recently lost 80 pounds.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks, and I've kept it off for 2 years already.
Mm.
But my head is constantly telling me I'm hungry. You should eat something, and I just, bear through it and say, no, you're not.
Hmm.
So I guess that's my question. How much does your perception have to do with the way your body reacts to food and so on?
I would like interested in both Rebecca and Janet's response.
Well, there are a lot of factors that can influence how much we perceive ourselves to be hungry and full. I think one of the major ones that I've studied is what we've eaten earlier. If you have eaten certain types of foods, for example, foods high in protein or foods low in energy density or high in volume, possibly foods low in glycemic index, all of the things that we hear about, many of those things will influence your hunger later on, as well as physical activity, which can suppress hunger. But as our previous caller said, I think another important and overlooked factor is environment and activities. And if a person is distracted and engaged in enjoyable activities, that might also reduce the impression of hunger because the food is there, that kind of hedonic hunger.
Rebecca, you want to comment?
Yeah, I also think that self-perception is also influenced very strongly by what our perceptions of societal attitudes are. And when it comes to societal attitudes about weight, as we've been talking about this whole time, they're very often very negative. And so what we know from research on weight bias and internalizing negative stigma is that some individuals react by actually eating more food as a coping strategy rather than, deciding to diet or something like that. And so I think that, there is this drive to eat more as a way to cope with some of the negative reactions or negative internalization of self-perception.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, anything else?
No, that's it. Thanks.
Thanks so much for calling. We'll take one more phone call. We're almost out of time. Tim from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. A lot of this sounds like it's a parenting decision. When I worked at a grocery store a couple of years ago, I noticed that the overweight families, there were a lot of processed foods, ho-hos, ding-dongs, all sorts of sweets in the shopping cart. And when I looked at the more fit, more apparently what appeared to be active families, I noticed things like carrots and, celery and fruits and vegetables and milk and, eating healthy-type foods.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be mostly parenting decisions that really comes down to it because the kids are home between 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock, and well, gee, what are we going to eat? What's in the fridge? Oh, there's carrots. All right, let's eat carrots. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, let's eat ho-hos or ding-dongs.
Right. Dr. Peel, you want to comment? We're getting short on time.
Sure, no problem. I think that, you know, it's common to kind of put blame on parents when it comes to obesity. And I think that certainly parents need more education, but we also need to create an environment that makes it easy for parents to feed their children healthy. And we currently do not do that. We know that unhealthy foods are much cheaper for families than healthier ones are. And there's also issues of availability and accessibility of healthy foods, which often are much harder to get than unhealthy foods. So I think that you raise a good point, although we need to really consider parenting in the larger context of the environment that we're living in.
Thank you both so much for being with us and for the study.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our guests, Rebecca Puhl. Dr. Puhl is Associate Research Scientist and Coordinator, Community and Weight Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, and Dr. Janet Lattner, Assistant Professor of Psychology at the University of Hawaii, and she is the editor of Self-Help Approaches for Obesity and Eating Disorders, Research and Practice. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Sharome Owens for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls, some of which I'm sure were not easy to make. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll return tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and that's that. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.